for some time now, and I think I must have spoken to every one of you several times about meditation, what it is, how to do it, how not to do it. I find over the months, over the years, quite an interesting picture builds up about meditation, about how people interpret the words they hear, the words they read about meditation. Especially is that true when we come to talk about the rise and fall of things. And so I thought I'd try and share some of those things with you this evening. And I've called my talk tonight, All You Ever Wanted to Know About the Rise and Fall. So let's start off with the real basics. Why attend to rise and fall at all? I think it would be fair to say that everyone who does so attends to rise and fall because they believe that there is a deeper dimension to life, one with which they can get in touch by pursuing that particular path. All right, rise and fall means meditation, rise and fall means all kinds of things, but the ultimate aim is to deepen one's appreciation of life, perhaps to seek hidden depths. In short, one seeks understanding. And that understanding is interpreted in a number of different ways, depending upon who is talking about it at the time. Many people are quite clear that what they want is freedom from the distress they find themselves in at the time. Others don't see it quite in that fashion. They rather want to overcome the frustration they feel because they don't know the way things work. And others, seeing perhaps even more clearly, say that what they're looking for is purity of mind. They recognize that the mind with which they go through their daily routine is cloudy, obscured, agitated, unhappy, depressed maybe, hateful, generally ill at ease. And what they seek is to get rid of all of that unease and find the purity of mind that so many religious ways, so many meditative ways actually point to. So those are some of the reasons why people might attend to rise and fall. But just what is it? You must have heard the term countless times by now. Rise and fall is used in many different contexts. It's used in many different ways. So what do we mean by rise and fall? If you take rise and fall as an external phenomenon, then it's quite simple to say that all things rise and fall. Mountains actually rise and fall. They literally do rise. Where two tectonic plates come together, gradually you get a mountain range building up. In time, weathering, the rain, the sun, ice, snow, frost, all of those things break down the mountains and they crumble and are washed away down into the sea, so mountains fall. True, it might take a geological age to do this, but mountains rise and fall. Rivers rise and fall. Trees, plants, and even planets and suns all rise and fall. The star we call our sun is in about, I think it's something like 5 million years, going to go nova, the scientists tell us. It too will come to an end. Everything has a beginning, everything has an end. Even the smaller things in the environment, they too come and go. Plants and flowers, insects, all kinds of things start and finish. On a more personal level, you can say that everything within your mind and your body, everything that is around you personally, all your possessions, those kinds of things, all of those have a beginning and an end. They rise and fall. Nothing lasts. We ourselves change. We are born, mature, hopefully mature anyway, grow up at least, and change again and die. The change at the latter end of life is decay. The change at the beginning is growth. But always there is rise and fall. No human lifespan can exceed, let's say, I don't know, 120 years at current estimates. So there is a beginning, there is an end. All these things rise and fall, all of these things are rise and fall. And yet how should we attend to rise and fall? Is it simply a matter of watching the abdomen, or is there much more to it than that? Well, as you may have guessed, there is of course much more to it than that. One should attend to rise and fall externally. You can do that by undertaking considerations such as we've just looked at, mountains rising and passing away, but those aren't particularly visible. But you can see rise and fall in the seasons. Seasons come and go. The weather changes markedly from season to season. That's what a season is, after all. Leaves appear on the trees in spring, lovely fresh green, darken through the summer, change colour again in the autumn, and fall off in the winter. You can observe rise and fall in natural things very, very easily. Nature is a wonderful source of material to use if you really want to observe rise and fall externally. Also externally, you can observe other people and things. You can see other people coming and going, either in a very short-term context, literally coming and going along a road, a street, in a room somewhere, or being born and dying, if you have a mind to look at it that way. Anything you can think of rises and passes away. Take the example of the car, which we say we've had for so very long. If we really look at that, we find it's composed of parts which continually are being replaced, or at least worn, if not replaced. All things can be seen to rise and fall. So the way to attend to rise and fall externally is to actually note the fact that all of these things are transient. They all rise and pass away. It's not good enough just to go along with a comfortable understanding that the world is as it is. You need to get right into the depths of it. Actually note for yourself that none of these things is lasting. On a personal level, also, it's important to note that things come and go. One needs to attend to one's own mental and physical states and actually remark upon the fact that they arise and they pass away, they rise and fall. And noting that all these things decay and die is indeed the basic practice of rise and fall. But we're concerned primarily with meditation. All of those things mentioned so far are vitally important, but usually they don't give you the penetration that you need to see how things really operate. So how do we attend to the rise and fall, meditatively speaking? We attend to the feeling of the rise and fall of the abdominal area that is brought about dependent upon the breathing process. Sounds simple enough. One would perhaps be forgiven for thinking that it couldn't be misinterpreted. The feeling of rise and fall in the abdominal area? Very obvious, isn't it? And yet you may be surprised at the number of ways the rise and fall of the abdomen can be attended to. Let me give you some examples. Some people look at the rise and fall of the abdomen and they find themselves with a distinct, small, and definite feeling that seems to run horizontally in and out about two fingers' breadth above the navel. It's as thick as a piece of string, as it were, putting it in visual terms, and it runs from a point about halfway through the body, back to front, and horizontally out towards the skin surface. They follow this feeling as it goes up, in other words, it rises towards the surface of the body and falls, going back in towards the centre. They find it fairly easy to perceive, they follow it carefully, religiously, and get quite calm and concentrated thereby. Others, yet again, find that they cannot distinguish anything like that at all. that all they can find is that the whole rib cage seems to go up and down around that area. So they're looking at something which may be, let's say, a foot in diameter, an area about a foot in diameter, which expands and contracts, goes in and out in a fairly regular way, but that doesn't have quite the same degree of fineness that the earlier example did. Other people find themselves located on the surface of the skin only, and their rise and fall is as the skin touches the clothing they may be wearing, and that particular pressure eases or strengthens. So there we are, several ways already of looking at rise and fall, and yet there are more. Some people manage to feel the actual surface of the diaphragm as it descends on the in-breath and feel a vertical movement about, what would it be, a third of the way into the body from the front, and moving up and down through about 2 or 3 inches in a very definite way. They feel that as rise and fall. Other people find that the whole thing is something of a mystery. They can't actually distinguish anything at all, and so they get tangled up with the idea of rise and fall, and they get caught up with their thoughts about it and assume that that is what is meant by attending to rise and fall, because they can't distinguish anything else. All of these are different ways of attending to rise and fall. As you can see, they vary enormously, and I've only given you a sort of broad selection here. To go into detail would take far too long. Although, speaking of detail, it's possible actually to attend to rise and fall by distinguishing the very organs, muscles and tissues in the abdominal area, and the pressure and the feeling seems to move through those. So you can distinguish, for example, the stomach wall, the muscles, the skin surfaces and so forth. All of these are ways of attending to rise and fall. Sometimes the feeling will be perceived as staying more or less still about a quarter of the way in to the body from the skin surface, and it will increase and decrease in pressure as you rise and as it rises and falls, as you breathe in, as you breathe out. So many different ways of attending to rise and fall. Now you're looking all terribly worried here. No need. Is there a best way? What is the best way? Well, you have to take into account one particularly important fact. Everybody, each individual person, is unique. Many times in the Buddha's day, there was all kinds of discussion about how people perceived rise and fall. Everyone perceives it slightly differently, sometimes radically differently. And that's quite in order. There is no problem with that. For our past conditioning is so varied that there's no conceivable way we can perceive things identically with one another. So everyone will perceive the rise and fall in a different way. It has to be said, though, with that, having made that disclaimer, that there is, generally speaking, a best group of ways of perceiving rise and fall, and that is to track in on the feeling in a fairly precise manner, so that one is able to follow it increasing and decreasing or rising and falling in a very definite way. Generally, that means sharpening the concentration to the point where one can distinguish that feeling. That means also then that one has to get away from the thinking process to a very considerable extent. So the best way then is really and truly to track in on the physical feeling and get that as clear as possible. So let's talk for a moment about right meditation, which is what we're leading up to after all. I'd like to emphasize that both samatha, that is calming meditations, meditations which tranquilize you, and vipassana meditations, in other words insight meditation, which we are primarily concerned with here, they both start off in exactly the same way. It doesn't matter whether you're training in calmness or insight, you have to do the same basic exercises to start with. What are they? The first step is to define the hindrances to meditation. In other words, to know what the obstacles you're facing actually are, what they consist of, and eventually how to deal with them. So what are the hindrances? There are five, basically speaking, but each one is just simply a different form of craving. So you can say all hindrances are different forms of craving, different forms of wanting things to be different than they are, different forms of not accepting the way things are, if you like. It's important to see that hindrances are things you do. They're not things you have. They don't descend upon you unbidden out of a cloudless sky and wrap you around the ear smartly. They are things actually that you do, you are responsible for, although they may have become so habitual that they've sunk below the level of consciousness, as it were. You do them without thinking, without awareness. Hindrances are those things which obscure purity of mind. Purity of mind isn't something you develop. It's something which is uncovered once you get rid of the hindrances. So you don't have to create it. You simply have to get rid of the hindrances. So how do you do that? How do you overcome all of these different forms of craving? You overcome the different forms of craving, you uncover purity of mind by developing the four right efforts. Buddhadhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, is paramount in the world, I would suggest, for its codified form of instruction. There are four of these, six of those, eight of those, ten of these, and so it goes. It's well worthwhile learning some of these lists off by heart if you have the time, if you have the inclination. For you find that when you're in a difficult spot in the meditation, very often a list comes to mind and clarifies the issue for you straight away. That cannot happen if the list has not been learned. The four right efforts are fairly obvious when you come to think about them. They are the effort to prevent negative states arising and to eradicate those negative states which are already there, and the effort to encourage positive states, and then the effort to maintain those positive states which you've managed to get going. Let me give you some examples. Sensual desire, indulgence in sensuality, is one of the major five hindrances. It's illustrated best, I think, by a gentleman whom we saw. He had been on a Catholic meditation retreat and he was being interviewed on television about it. And he said, well, he found on the whole that the retreat had been extremely difficult between meals. I know that quite a few of you have felt the same way at times. And you find that your mind is filled with thoughts of food, meals you're going to make, meals you have had, meals you're going to have, and so it goes, hour after hour. Now, clearly, that's an obstacle to purity of mind, to the calmness and tranquility, the spaciousness that you can uncover in the meditation practice. So what should you do in a case like that? You should recognize, firstly, that you are doing it. You are thinking these thoughts. They're not just happening to you willy-nilly. You're putting energy into the fantasies, the memories, the imaginings, and you can withdraw that energy, you can restrain it. You can say, no, I won't think like that. But that's only part of it. If you simply do that, you'll find yourself trapped again and again in thinking about food or whatever it might be. You need also to do something positive beyond the restraint, and that is to concentrate on what you're doing in the moment. If you're sitting down, that means concentrating on, say, the rise and fall of the abdomen. To bend the mind in a direction which is positive in respect of the meditation. If you're walking about in between meditations, then concentrate on your walking. Concentrate on the actual feeling in the soles of the feet as you walk along. That sort of thing. You'll find that the mind becomes filled with those matters rather than food. You're going to have to keep the effort up, mind you, because it's all too easy to slip back in. What about ill will? Hatred, irritability, feeling generally fed up. It's not unknown for people to become quite fed up with the place, with themselves, with their fellow meditators from time to time. What can you do in a situation like this, where every which way you look, you see something to criticize, something to find fault with? It does happen. Not many people like to admit it, but it certainly does happen, and it is a most definite obstacle to right meditation. You can overcome such ill will by learning to count your blessings. That may sound a little unusual, but it's extraordinarily effective. Think how well off actually you are. You've got food in your belly, a roof over your head, clothes on your back, a fairly comfortable lifestyle judged by the standards of some other places in the world. You're doing the thing that you've always wanted to do when you're in your right mind, that is, and that is come to know more about yourself, come to greater understanding and peace of mind. All of those things are extremely positive, and recounting them to yourself, you find that the mind lightens. It begins to get a little bit more joy in there. It gladdens the mind. And with that, the ill will tends to disappear. If then you do some metta, some loving kindness meditation, to yourself, to the place, to the people around you, you can completely turn around that obstacle. You can completely eliminate it for the time being. Sloth and torpor are problems which face many people from time to time in the meditations, and it has to be clearly distinguished which kind it is that we're talking about. There's sloth, pure and simple, which is laziness. It's comfortable, it's daydreamy, it's full of fantasies, and it sort of dawdles along, having really quite a nice time, but being rather addicted to sleep. That's one kind. Then there's torpor, which is that stiffness and rigidity that comes from excessive effort. You put in a lot of application, really, to get going with the meditation, and it goes rigid on you and turgid, stodgy and uncomfortable. Sometimes very painful too. The way to overcome sloth is by trying harder, by putting in more effort. The way to overcome torpor, stiffness, is by relaxing, by taking it easy, by developing things like calm and tranquility. And of course, overall, mindfulness. It's a rather similar picture when we look at agitation. You have to distinguish quite clearly between agitation on the one hand and doubt on the other. Agitation is where the mind's jumping about. It's like it's got fireworks going off all over the place. Jumping around from this to that, ideas buzzing, so many things going on that you don't know where to turn next. It may take for some people the form of planning, often does in fact, and one of the most common activities on a residential course is to be planning the next interview. Just what are you going to say? How are you going to present it? What do you think you should present? What should you keep back? What can you make up and get away with? Planning, planning, planning. And if it isn't planning the interview, then it's planning what you're going to do when you finally get out and home for the weekend. Planning is a severe problem. Agitation is a severe problem. And again, you have to recognize that it's something you do, something that you choose to indulge in if you like. So it's dealt with by restraining that particular pattern of behavior, saying, I will not indulge this kind of planning. I will keep the mind in the moment. I will try to relax. I will try and stay calm. I'll try and develop some equanimity. What does it matter anyway, what I say? Hopefully, if the teacher's any good, he or she will know what's going on anyway. Indeed, perhaps this is the point to say that often the questions Jack and I might ask, and when we get you to describe what's going on, it's not necessarily because we don't know what's going on. It's because we want to see if you know what's going on. For it's not always apparent. Knowledge, in that sense, is quite invisible. You cannot know whether someone knows what's going on. It's very obvious what is going on, but whether they know it or not is another matter. So what about the last one in the series? What about doubt? If you're doing your meditation properly, you will come across a series of hours, or maybe days, maybe longer, when doubt is something of a problem. You'll come to doubt the place, the teacher, you'll come to doubt the meditation, you'll come to doubt yourself. You'll come to wonder what on earth it's all about, what you're doing in this stupid place anyway, doing these silly things, sitting here hour after hour, and the doubts will run on and on. Why? Generally, it's because the investigation side of the meditation has got quite strong. You're starting to see more clearly into things and become interested, and so you've generated greater investigation than actually you need. That investigation sees so many different sides to things that you cannot resolve them. You cannot come up with an answer, and so the doubts start. So one of the ways of coping with doubt is to restrain the investigation, to generate, if you like, a little more confidence in what you're doing, and just ride through the difficult patches. That and asking intelligent questions when you get the opportunity. For intelligent questions, and their answers obviously, can very often settle the doubt and make life very much more easy for the time being. So, practicing right meditation then, you identify the hindrances, you learn to overcome them, and you finally arrive, through that process, at purity of mind. So just what is purity of mind? How do you recognize it when it's there? What do you do with it? Do you do anything? Purity of mind is essentially freedom from hindrances. Going back to what I was saying earlier, that means that it is, in fact, freedom from wanting things to be different than they are. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is utter calm externally and internally. There may, in fact, be quite a lot going on. There can be a lot of external agitation, for example, and yet the mind can still be free from hindrances. You can have a severe pain in the back, for example, and yet still be free from hindrances. It's important to recognize it's these five hindrances that we're talking about, each one of which has an element of craving within it. So if the hindrances have gone, there is no craving, there is no wanting, there is no wanting things to be different. And it's like being let out of prison, you know? Or you do know, I know you do. It's like being let out of prison. The mind goes quiet, goes still, it goes spacious. You feel as though you have all the time in the world. You feel quite contented to be where you are, doing what you're doing. And in most cases, the body is calm as well. And so there's a distinct feeling of well-being. And when it first happens, it truly is like being let out of prison, or having paid off the mortgage, overcome that debt at last, suddenly free from shackles of one sort or another. It really is quite exciting in a quiet way. Purity of mind represents a perfect balance of mental factors. Mindfulness is good, concentration is good, the effort is right, there's plenty of confidence in what you're doing, and there's just the right amount of investigation. Nothing is excessive, everything is just so. What should you do about it? Well, there are two things. One of the first things to do is learn to look at that particular state of mind, that purity of mind, and to do nothing about it, just to maintain it, simply to keep it there, simply to observe, just to watch, just to let it be. That in itself takes a certain amount of restraint, for so every so often the wanting to do something creeps back in. But just to stay with that is not enough. We have at some point to deepen the meditation. So how do we do that? Well, here we have to look at, this is the point at which the two kinds of meditation, calming meditations on the one hand and insight meditation on the other, this is the point at which those two diverge. Let's look briefly at calming meditations then. How would you deepen the meditation from the point of purity of mind? Samatha, calming meditations, are dependent upon ever deepening tranquility and equanimity. So those are the things you have to enhance, those are the things you have to encourage, those are the things you have to work upon. If you deepen the tranquility, get yourself calmer and calmer and calmer, whilst it has to be said staying fully conscious, that's important obviously, then you get to a point where you hit what are known as the fixed meditations or jhanas, where everything goes completely stable in a way quite unlike the initial purity of mind. Initial purity of mind is seen to be slightly rocky because you know things can come in and upset it quite easily. But the jhanas, the fixed meditations, have this strong feeling of fixity. And that's even more delightful in terms of calmness than the purity of mind I was talking about. It's also possible, having done that, to go further and develop what are known as the psychic powers, to actually consciously and intelligently develop things like knowing the minds of others, being able to, what I think would be called today, astral travel, and things of that nature. Fascinating field of study, but one that doesn't really concern us as insight meditators, for the whole of the psychic field can prove to be an enormous detour, and in the end, not particularly helpful in terms of generating understanding. If we are to deepen the meditation towards the goal of insight, we have to take a slightly different tack. To develop understanding requires a great deal of observation and investigation. So the key here, instead of developing calmness, we develop the investigation and observation without haste, without pushing it, without forcing the pace in any way. What this does is to give us an ever more subtle experience of the three marks. Now, the three marks are things which inhere in every single experience, everything. Everything is transient, everything is unsatisfactory in the sense that you can't do anything with it because it doesn't last, and it's non-self. It doesn't have a discrete central core that we can grasp hold of. So deepening the meditation towards insight gives us an ever more subtle experience of these three marks, and this is often painful, for it brings us in confrontation with our own mistaken ideas. I think that's really one of the toughest things about insight meditation. Constantly one is up against it, in the sense that every new insight challenges some of the treasured notions, ideas, and concepts that one has held perhaps for years and years. And these things have to be thrown out in the light of new experience. It sometimes means a radical reappraisal of the way one sees the world. But pursuing that path, eventually, whether we're talking about concentration or insight, you can get freedom from clinging, freedom from suffering. You can get an established purity of mind, which is quite delightful. The freedom of mind gained through samatha, through calming meditations, is temporary. It's freedom through suppression. Many people find that they get that freedom of mind through working. When they work hard, all of their cares, all their troubles drop away. and they become completely entranced by the work they're doing. Indeed, they may even become workaholics if they find that it's successful. Other people take to different forms of activity, but like sports, for example. They too force concentration upon a single object and cut out all of the hindrances. Meditation is a much purer form of the same basic idea, that intense concentration on a single item, single object, single process can remove you entirely from the hindrances for a considerable length of time. And that freedom from clinging is also a freedom from suffering. But there is a problem with it. It gives great calmness, but it develops little or no understanding. The effects are not lasting, and the cause of suffering, craving, is only put aside temporarily. For permanent freedom, we need to look to vipassana, insight meditation. Here, the understanding gained is the thing which cuts through the roots of craving, cuts through the ever-present hindrances to eradicate and destroy them altogether. Through insight meditation, we come to know from experience that there is no lasting thing at all in the world. Whatever you look at, whatever you experience, with whatever sense, there is nothing that lasts in the world. When you know that for a fact, by experience, then it's not that you put craving aside. It's that you are completely unable to crave for something, to cling to something that you know does not last for more than such a fleeting instant of time. It could be said, in a sense, not to exist at all. So it's not that you then choose to stop craving for things. It's not that you then choose to stop wanting things to be different. It's that you find yourself utterly unable to want things to be different, for you know that they are constantly in flux all the time, and that there is no thing to be different at all anyway. Indeed, if you come to the fullest depths of understanding, then there is nothing more to do, for you have developed through that a completely different way of seeing the world. One which in some religions is described as being reborn, truly reborn, not believing that you've been reborn, but utterly having transformed yourself internally. And that indeed is a major step. The joys of enlightenment can be catalogued in many different ways, but some of the most cogent, I think, are these. Firstly, there comes to be a total absence of fear. There is no fear of the present, whatever it may be, whether there are disasters like earthquakes, or whether it's simply the interest rate going up yet another terrible notch. There is no fear in the present. Nor is there any fear of the future. For the mind doesn't play those what-if games with any intensity at all. It simply is content to let things unfold the way they will, taking any reasonable precautions that may be appropriate. And that having no fear of the future means that there is absolutely no fear of death whatsoever. For having seen by experience the death of everything you've ever looked at, whether externally or internally, having seen that all things die, all things pass away, having seen that and understood it fully, there can never again be any fear of death. One reason, of course, why Nibbana, the state of enlightenment, is called the deathless, for there is never again any death. So one of the major joys of enlightenment is this absence of fear. The other is the contentment that develops. There's a total contentment with what is. You come to understand at the very deepest level, there is absolutely no need to change yourself. You are perfect as you are. There is nothing that needs changing. And going along with that, and also a tremendous relief, is the recognition that there's no need to change others, something that many people spend an awful lot of time trying to do. Recognizing that there's no need to change yourself and that there's no need to change others brings with it a tremendous joy and peace. In moments of solitude, there upwells an enormous joy which is almost too great to contain. It is absolutely exquisite and really cannot be described. And yet with that joy, there's the fundamental underlying peace, which again is impossible to put into words properly. If there's no joy, then at the very least there's a deep and stable equanimity, a complete contentment with the way things are, be they never so tough or be they very pleasant. The joys of enlightenment then are basically two: absence of fear and contentment with what is. And these are the very things that most people come to meditation for. These are the very things that most people undertake to look at the rise and fall to try and discover. And these are the very things that you will discover if you pursue the observation of the rise and fall successfully.